Good. And no, good evening, everyone. Just taking you all in again. I've been sitting here with you, but in meditation, it's now time to look up and soak you in. So great. Glad to be here with you. What's on my mind tonight? Something I've touched into a few days ago, and I wondered then, it's like, I wonder if that would be something maybe to talk about. It seemed like it. And now it turns out it is. So it's kind of been just underground for the past few days, but it's also something that's comes up periodically, at least part of this, comes up periodically from me and as we navigate this way of practice together, where it started this time was in conversation with somebody else on Friday, no, on Thursday. And what the thing is the story of the origin of the Rakkasu, these bib-like things that we wear when we take vows. So the story we have of the times that were happening in China in which, during which the Rakkasu was birthed. It was during one of the several great persecutions of Buddhism that happened in China. Looking it up, there's said to be three major persecutions of Buddhism over several centuries, and this was the third of those. In 845, called the Weizhong persecution. And there was an emperor named Wuzong who was a Taoist and felt very strongly about Taoism being the only religion in the country because it's Chinese. And he considered, you know, Buddhism, that's a foreign religion. It didn't come from China, so we must get rid of it. And it wasn't just Buddhism. It was several other religions, Zoroastrianism, Christianity, other religions of the day. He just put an order out to suppress them all, not let them be practiced. So in the case of Buddhism, the many forms of Buddhism that had developed by that time, so not just Chan or Zen, but all the Buddhisms, the monastics, those who were living in temples and monasteries, were kicked out and forcibly defrocked, their robes taken away. You weren't allowed to wear your monastic robes anymore. You needed to go into the regular life, get a job, do the normal thing, support the economy. That was one of the things, but it was also as a way to raise money for war. And so part of that process was destroying temples and taking the statues that could be melted down and, you know, the gold and silver and all of that. So just in regard to Buddhism, there were about 4,600 temples at that time, and they got reduced down to 49. So roughly 99% gone. They just destroyed those temples. Kept a few around to allow some people to keep practicing a little bit. But that's pretty massive, yeah. And then said there were like 260,000 monastics around that time. And that got reduced to 800. And if I did my math correctly, that's about 0.3% of what it had been. Some were killed. Many were just forced again to go back into lay life and leave the temple, lead a normal life, support the country. Do things like that. So it was in those times, with that happening, not being able to wear the robes anymore, the story goes, they came up with a way to create a robe very much like the story we tell when somebody takes refuge. The building of a rakazu is like building of a large robe where you take different scraps and pieces and sew them all together into one. And the ring here, there's a big ring in the kesa, is what it's called in Japanese, at least, the kesa robe. So they kind of just miniaturized it, created this robe that you could then wear beneath your work clothes. So reclaiming or holding on to that meaningful garment, that precious, symbolic, but also personal connection. And to me, I love the fact that it seems that it brought the practice even more intimately into people's lives, because now the robes were right against your skin, beneath your clothes, rather than the clothes over the underclothes. Yeah, they were. This was the underclothes, hidden. Nobody else could see it. Close, intimate to you. And I really love that, the feeling of that. And that's kind of maybe when we take refuge and we sew our rakazu, we have a similar journey of finding the intimacy of the practice so close. It's like our skin. It's on our skin. It's right there. Yeah. So during that time of great trouble and hardship, persecution, discovering a way to keep something alive, maybe to enliven it, yeah, to bring it, it was forced out of what the container had been before, and maybe that spread it into a wider container, a wider space, a more adaptable space, the practice itself in that symbolic way. Regardless, you know, it's like, oh, don't have to be in the monastery to have this practice in this way. Don't have to have a particular life with that particular schedule of the monastery. You can have this normal life, tending to family, working, taking care of community in the villages and things like that. And certainly having conversations and teaching and having community, sangha, just in the everyday happening there too. Discovering, well, though the outer, the surface level, the physical, the location, all that stuff, though that's all gone, something remains, goes on and comes forth anew, yet still a continual thread from what was before. So the reason this story came up, or how it came up in the conversation I had with this person the other day, was earlier in that day, during our community meditation time and conversation, somebody brought in how, you know, during this time of pandemic and shutdown, appreciating the discovery that their practice wasn't dependent upon getting together in person like we had been doing all the time before. Which is not to say it's not important to get together in person, and certainly looking forward to being able to do that again. But to discover, oh, I thought that was really the essential thing, was we have to be able to get together in person physically and share the space, breathe the same air, you know, and interact in that particular way. Because that's what we'd always done. So then to come into a pandemic, persecution, a pandemic, I don't know. I like that there's a rhyme here, yeah? All of a sudden, all that life that you've been living for all this time, you can't do it anymore. Instead of being kicked out, you're kicked in. Kicked further into your house. And you can't go and do the normal things you had done before. You can't gather together. And you have to try to find out how to navigate your life, how to live in this way, including more than just this practice that we share, But that was one of the major things for me. I remember wondering, even before there was a pandemic, I had this idea of trying to maybe create an online opportunity for meditation, because I have some students who are in other states and don't have communities. But I was very resistant to it because I thought, it's going to be over a screen with technology. That'll be weird. You can't connect like that. So it was on my mind for months, but I never initiated it because it just seemed like that's not going to work. Well, then this came about. Our circumstances changed, and it was like, well, here we go. Let's see if it works. And I still was, I remember at the beginning, starting off thinking, well, I'll do this for a little bit, but I don't know if it'll last. But it did. It still is. Here we are doing this. And other offerings happening with other communities, people keep showing up, keep getting something from this. Not only, at the beginning, like I said, for me, it was kind of a temporary, we'll just do this for now. And that's transformed into, wow, this is really powerful and wonderful. And I like the fact that it challenged my ideas of what it takes and how deeply we can connect in person versus through screens. And it's wonderful to see and to experience deep connection and to have something, not a physical weaving, not a physical robe thing constructed, but to weave together and to construct something out of the life that we're given right now that's powerful and meaningful, and is that thread running through that was there before and here now. And just like with, you know, after that persecution in China lasted 20 months, and then they were able to go back into monastic life, those who had been kicked out. And the reason it was the final of the three great persecutions is that Buddhism overall was pretty damaged and couldn't recover fully because of it, except for Chan. Chan did all right. Chan came back and was able to reestablish itself enough that we have a tradition today, yeah? And we have these rakkasus today that are symbolic of that time, but also the continuation of the tradition from before that time and on into whatever's beyond this time. So just as, you know, the rakkasu was born in those times and then became a regular feature afterwards, I'm curious what's being born, what's being woven together and created during this time that we're already experiencing that will then be carried forward from here when we are able to get back together in person. And lean more into that whenever that time comes. Yeah. Well, what of this will remain? I'm curious. And what else will we have learned in our lives beyond practice that will be useful, that will carry into our lives wherever we are, with family, with work, you know, all the other things we've been discovering. It's like, well, we really didn't need a meeting to accomplish that. It could have just been done in email. Maybe that'll happen more and more regularly. You know, less board meetings and long meetings of sitting around that table with PowerPoints, yeah? finding out, well, I really can streamline my time and give more to this, less to that. You know, whatever it is, what we're discovering, which is born out of necessity and circumstance right now, but may have application further. Time will tell, and we will be the tellers of it, the ones carrying forward and seeing what remains. And so I'm curious about that. Because I know, you know, this Zoom thing will continue in some fashion, but it'll be nice personally when it's not the primary way anymore, when things shift. Yeah. So very much looking forward to returning to the in-person thing, but also entering into the in-person thing anew, with new eyes, new energy. an expanded sense of what practice is. And that's what I feel here too, is it's not that initial thing again was maybe feeling like a temporary replacement of the other practice, the other way of practicing. It's a temporary replacement, and then we'll get back to it. Instead of this being a replacement, it's like an expansion of practice. Oh, we can do it that way, and we get to do it this way. And when we get beyond, those two will maybe not be two. They'll be just a wider field of the potential of practice, the ways of doing it. So with that curiosity about what may happen in the afterward for us, a couple of stories from the afterward of the persecution time in China come to mind. There's one I came across a long time ago, and I couldn't find it again, so I don't know the specifics, but like, there was this one teacher who had, his hair had grown out, maybe his beard had grown out, and everything during the persecution, and then it was time to go back to the monastery, and I think he kind of slowly went back there because he was like, it's all right where I'm at. You know, I don't know if I need to do that. But slowly returned to the monastery, and the community returned as well. But he didn't shave his head or didn't clean off his beard, and he kept wearing his regular clothes right there in the monastic practice, getting everything going again. He was still connected with that other way of being physically in his appearance. He just let that remain. Until enough people said, would you just please shave your head? It would help us feel better if you looked like a teacher like we expect you to. Can you just do it? And saying, like, well, okay, he relented at some point. But it's nice that he was not too quick to just jump into those old forms, maybe allowing the what had been discovered to meet what had been before to become something new and allow it to integrate and mingle together over time. So not rushing into it. Allowing that organic, natural process to maybe inform him of when it was time, yeah, to do that shaving of the head, putting back on of the robes with the rakazu on top, not underneath anymore, yeah. Another story that comes to mind is regarding the teacher Muzhou, who was known as being a pretty strict and kind of fierce teacher. The story we have is that he would often just be up in his room, like a little hermitage, but there in the complex of the monastery, and just keep his door closed and wouldn't see people, you know, for days. If his door was open and somebody was coming, he'd close it. And then if they wanted to come in, he probably wouldn't open it right away. They may have to come back several times. And then when he did open it, he just got right to the point, you know, kind of, again, strict, a little fierce. Well, during a different persecution, a rebellion that followed a few years after the persecution I just spoke of, and maybe during the persecution itself, I don't have the story about that, but he just went back home and mended sandals for people in order to raise money to take care of his mom who was sick. So here's this teacher, this, you know, Chan master. The rebellion came, the persecution came, you couldn't be in the monastery anymore, so he went home and took care of his mom by making sandals. And then we have this one story. He was the teacher for Yunmen, and there's a story about Yunmen coming and knocking on the door, being one of those people trying to get in to see him. And so we have this story I told you before. He's like, he's not going to see you. You've got to persist and knock on the door a few days. And it's like, I wonder what he's up to in there. Something mysterious. Well, maybe he's just in there making more sandals. And he can't be bothered with the practice stuff. He's like, I've got to make more sandals to make money, to raise money to take care of my mom. That's what I'm doing in there. Not so fierce. Pretty compassionate. So that's something that carried over from having left the monastery. He brought that back. Oh, I can use the time here to keep supporting mom, taking care of her. Yeah. Yeah. And something else, you know, that came out of that persecution time in a different way is many of the characters and the people from our koan liturgy that, you know, that period They come from that period. Linji, Dongshan, Daishan, Yunmin, Guishan. You know, all these names. You see them. They show up many times in the koans, and they were the ones living in the midst of this persecution. And so, their way of living and the stories that became koans or remain stories for us to take up out of the encounters they had with one another, it was during that period. So who knows what the stories will be from our time here as we carry along as we are and then move into what's next. The tales to tell. The future generations. Who will they be seeing us as? Yeah. Don't know that we'll get to see that, but we'll get to be creating it here and now and how we are responding and how we are connecting with one another and what we are creating, what we are realizing and bringing along with us. Yeah. So, wanted to bring in a koan that came to mind to accompany all this. This is one of those times where the koan came second. Sometimes more often, it's like the koan comes first and then I hang out with it. This is one of those where I was hanging out with this, then the koan showed up and said, I'd like to partake and contribute. And it happens to be Yunmin, Muzhou's student and eventual great teacher, showing up, one of the ones shows up quite prominently in the koans. This one's Yunmin's One Treasure in the Center. Yunmin said, in the center of the cosmos, inside heaven and earth, there is one treasure hidden in the body. It picks up a lantern and walks into the meditation hall. It brings the entrance gate and puts it on top of the lantern. So this, in the center of the cosmos, inside heaven and earth, that's right here. This center of the cosmos, inside of this heaven and earth, right here, where you are, where I am, this place we are together, that place, there is one treasure right here, hidden in the body. I consider it hidden in this body of mine, but also hidden in the body of reality. The body of what is in the forms around me. One of the translations just says hidden in the body of form. So right here in this place, which is the center of the cosmos and the inside of heaven and earth, there's a treasure in this very place. And the hidden part is interesting to me. My mind wants it to be hidden, like somewhere in there it's hidden and I've got to find it. But my experience, my heart mind, you know, speaking, kicking the mind into the wider territory, feels it's more like hidden in plain sight, hidden as the body, in the body, woven into it. Yeah, it's hidden. So you can't see it. And it's not like this small treasure that's hidden somewhere within the larger form. It's woven. It is the form. Therefore, you cannot really see it because it's everywhere. It permeates. Yeah. That's my experience of this being hidden in the body. So it's another way of saying right here and now in your life, within you, in these circumstances, there's a treasure. You can't necessarily see it. Yeah. But it's here. And then the knowing that it's here comes with that next part through the activity, the action. It picks up a lantern and walks into the meditation hall. Why the meditation hall, I wonder? Likely because when Yunmin said this, he was talking to people who had come into the meditation hall. Or maybe they were in the lecture hall and afterwards they were going to head into the meditation hall with their lanterns. It's just saying, and this is what's going to happen next. It does what you do, this treasure. It picks up a lantern and heads into the meditation hall. So it opens the email and finds the link, clicks and joins into the Zoom room. He sits down and follows the bells and does walking meditation and listens to a talk. He has dinner before or after, you know, that thing. And what if in all that activity, it's the carrying of the lantern, yeah? Maybe the monastics there were literally going to carry a lantern, but what if this treasure is always carrying a lantern, always carrying a light, yeah? Wherever you are, wherever you go, the light that's in whatever is, yeah? So that's another translation. It walks around with an inherent light. And then it brings the entrance gate and puts it on top of the lantern or joins it with the light. That's where it gets like, okay, what's this? You know, if you think literally, that gets a little strange. How did that happen? Yeah. The entrance gate to a monastery known as the Mountain Gate, you know, big thing that you walked through, many people could walk through. And there's two sections up top and there's, I think, three rooms up there. And inside of one of the rooms are statues of bodhisattvas and arhats and protectors, all these beings protecting the Dharma, blessing the way, offering things of that sort. So whenever you walk into the monastery, you're getting the blessings and the protections of the way. Yeah. So this is saying this treasure goes and grabs that entrance gate and brings it to where the light is. And then to simplify it for me, it just becomes, this is the place to enter. The light shines and creates a place to enter with all the bodhisattvas and arhats. Yeah. All the protections, all the blessings. The light creates that gate for them to be right here, wherever you are. Yeah. So it's kind of reduce it even further. Wherever there's a light, there's a gate. And the light's everywhere. It's in everything. It's hidden in the form of all things. So there's a gate here with that light in the form of all things. So wherever you are, there's an entry. There's a place to enter. There's a gate for you and for others. Maybe you are the gate for others, and others are the gate for you at times, yeah? So what it feels like, considering both these times, the persecution in China time, that treasure hidden in the body, hidden in the forms, in the circumstances, left the monastery, went into the cities, went into the jobs, the marketplace, was woven of normal clothes and wove itself into a rakazu, shining a light there and creating an entrance gate at the same time. Here's where you enter this life, right here. Yeah. And then in our times, this house of yours that you'll be in more often than you thought. And these ways of being in community across distances that are actually greater than we could before. We were traveling to different states and even people from different countries joining in, and we're traveling all over. Well, that's the treasure creating the practice space, the light shining and the entrance gate appearing here on a screen and with your loved ones, your friends and family. The light is being carried by the treasure there, shining, and the gate, the entranceway, the blessings and the protections, and the enjoyment of what is and what's happening and the possibilities right here, right there, always. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I'm enjoying that. Kind of relax a little bit, sit back and notice, well, what is this treasure doing and what is it making possible and how is it happening? I don't know if I can figure that out. It's a wonder, but it's happening deeply and richly. That treasure carrying the light, opening a way. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm wondering, for each of us, you might consider. What's the treasure, this treasure within your circumstances, within you? What's it been up to these past months? What's it up to now, yeah? And that lantern, you know, I don't know that it's the same lantern every time. There's light there, but sometimes it's a rickety old lantern that's just barely held together. Sometimes it's a brand new shiny one with plenty of fuel, or batteries are fresh if you're using that kind of lantern. You know, the light changes in various ways, but the lantern and the carrying of the light, I should say, the carrying of the light, the carrier changes, but the carrying comes through all those circumstances. So you might wonder, along with, what's this treasure been up to? What is it up to now? You might be curious about the lanterns and the light of it, of them that you've been encountering and still encounter, yeah? And what kind of gates have you passed through? Are you passing through? And maybe do you see opening, inviting you to enter again and again and again? As we journey along this way through pandemic and lockdown, and sometimes it feels like persecution, but not the same as the one long ago, but not that different either. Underneath it all, at the bottom of it. So right here, in our circumstances, in our lives, in your life, just as you are, there is a treasure hidden in and as all of that. It picks up a lantern and walks into the meditation hall, into the Zoom room, into the email, into the living room that's become the office, perhaps. And wherever it goes, wherever it walks, it brings that entrance gate and joins it with the light, letting you know that the light's always here, and where there's a light, there's a gate. And where there's a gate, there's an entry. So enter there, yeah. Yeah, so thank you. That's it for the long portion of my thing, so we'll see what comes now. Hopefully, well, I'm really curious to hear how this is for you and what maybe you're noticing now in shining that light in retrospect over these past many months, but also what's here right now in front of you. What light have you noticed? What gates and entryways? All that stuff I was curious about. So we have time for conversation and exploration together. And you can just unmute yourself when you'd like to speak. So we don't need to do the electronic hand thing. If you want, you can do that thing and I'll wave back.
Andrew.
Sorry, I was watching Sarah, then I didn't see
you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go, go, go.
Okay.